Okay, we've got to start. Katie, so
all right.
What is the topic today?
So we were going to do part two of The Medium and the Light.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's chapters 4 through 12. So we'll just begin. Okay?
Okay. All right.
So chapter 4 is an edited transcript of an informal address that Marshall gave to the 12th Annual Seminarians Conference at St. Michael's College. Okay?
1959, right?
1959, August.
Okay.
And so he's just him giving a talk, highlighted some things. This chapter is entitled Communication Media, Makers of the Modern World. Now, do you know why this is titled that?
Well, he's talking about the electric age, media environments create new spaces.
Okay.
New environments. That's what he means.
Okay. So he starts out by saying, but in the world about us, the endless decisions that are being taken by many kinds of people are taken habitually in an atmosphere in which everything happens at once, which we know McLuhan says a lot. And that is also shows his influence of Joyce because the here comes everyone. So that's where he starts out. And then he gets into talking about the artist and says that the artist no longer suggests that art is something that you can take or leave, that it's for some people and not for other people. The artist insists on absolute relevance. And this is him talking about how the environment presses on us for decisions. And so in the electric age, actually life is art, which we've talked about before.
Does he actually say that, life is art?
No, but I'm saying that. That's my take on what he's saying. Do you want to say something?
Well, okay, that means
to
the chemical
that?
Body. Yeah, the chemical body is the content of the new electric superangelic state, the electrified disembodied state. So everything the body does becomes an art form, becomes something that people try to improve or change or alter. They feel the need to take vitamins. Or back then to weightlift, or change where they live. So a lot of restlessness in the physical body because people are feeling the pressures of a new maker, a new environment, which is not limited to the chemical body. So the beginning of American narcissism, you could say, the bodybuilding contest, the beauty pageant. The excessive emphasis on those things, magazines about it, this all really surfaces in the late 50s, early 60s. And
plastic surgery for other than...
Beg your pardon?
And that's probably when plastic surgery started, right? With Maxwell Maltz and Marilyn Monroe, and it wasn't just for soldiers anymore.
Right, so if Carolyn could wiki that and find out when it started... But the important thing is that people, literate cultural commentators in the 50s, 60s are saying America is getting spoiled under the new post-World War II abundance, materialist abundance. You know, everybody's moving to the suburbs, they get their cars and swimming pools and stuff like that, or a lot of people aren't. Even the blacks are all nicely dressed for school. If you ever seen those pictures, there used to be movies of African nations around the world, under United Nations guidance, people properly going to school in third world countries, and they're all lined up looking the same, imitating the printed book, having the same school uniform on. It was actually, at least the way it was presented in the films by the United Nations, it looked pretty civilized in Africa, in the third world. Nobody could see 10 years later they'd be butchering themselves with death squads and civil wars and nut stuff happening everywhere, violence. That's not the image you saw in the late 50s, early 60s. But the CIA started it in one way by killing Patrice Lumumba about 1960 in the Congo or someplace. They started to meddle because these third world countries under the tribal effect of electric media naturally gravitated to communism. They didn't have the individualist print bias to even be like us. So the electric media made them appear to be communist, but it was just a modern form of tribal nationalism. So the guys at headquarters in the surveillance world were purposely or not misinterpreting everything. And now look at us. Now it's a wonderful world. I'm glad we got it off our chest back then.
Yes, definitely.
So what other thing to say about that? So Americans were considered to be becoming more and more leisure society. So everybody, the commentators, took it as looking at the chemical body and what it was doing to itself without realizing there was a new body afoot, the electrified body, which was going to cause the identity crisis and the violence that was coming.
Mm-hmm.
It would erase people's image of themselves. So McLuhan knows this. He knows what's coming. So, but this is 1959. This is like the beginning of the happy early 60s, at least in the media landscape. So what do you want to say he mentions next?
So next, he goes on to talk about art, specifically after he's mentioned that artists demand to be relevant. He starts to talk about Cézanne and his followers.
Yeah.
And how they had adequate reasons for abandoning perspective and pictorial space in favor of a more formal space. So it's the
now,
concept
formal space,
that...
Formal space means studying paint and light as a medium, not trying to have the content match what you would see in anthropomorphic scenes. All right? You're
mm-hmm.
going to look at light mm-hmm. and the act of painting as a formal thing to play with.
And that things have formal character and are able to speak for themselves.
Does
so the artist's
that?
Role is not... He does. He says, so the simple
yeah.
discovery was made in all the arts around 1860 to 1870 was that things have formal character and are quite able to speak for themselves. The artist's role is not to stress himself or his own point of view, but to let things sing and talk to release the forms from within them.
Yeah, and that's
so,
to the telegraph. See, that's
how,
the electric
effect is
coming in. What
Michelangelo did, Bob.
No, what did he do?
Well, that's what he said about art. He said that, that was Leonardo da Vinci. Or who did the Statue of David? I'm sorry, I don't know. Was that Michelangelo?
That was Michelangelo.
Okay, so he said he just released David from the stone. He just removed everything that wasn't David. So how is that different than this?
That's still looking at the stone as content, and then something emerges from it. I don't think Cézanne is doing that. He's probing the act of painting itself.
Okay.
Whereas Michelangelo, in the literate age, is still... Books make you think there are contents, because there was speech was the content of the book. So this idea of content... is what Michelangelo is doing. How he allows it to happen is unique. He lets the form come out of the stone, but he's still trying to make something be the content of the stone.
Got it.
Now, the guy that started to look at stone as a sculptor in the modern way, like Cézanne, is Gaudier-Bauzisca, G-A-U-D-I-E-R. He was a friend of Wyndham Lewis and the famous vorticist sculptor, had some interesting theories about what he was trying to do with it, which are written up in Blast, 1914. But he dies about a year later and in World War One. So,
was he 27?
Good point. It's interesting. I think he's a little younger than that. But we'll
yeah,
look
I
up.
Think so, too. If he was a soldier, he was probably a little younger.
Yeah, it was the first year, but he's 20. Now, you can see a movie about him. It's called Savage Messiah. By Ken Russell, about 1972. Good movie. It's about the vorticist art scene in London, focusing on him and his artist's girlfriend, or someone he was trying to hook up with. Let's see what his age is.
And then I'm going to send myself a note about that movie. What's it called again, The Savage Messiah?
Savage Messiah, which for years was hard to see, but I think it's available Maybe even I can look it up on YouTube. Just let me just look up Gautier Brzezinski.
Sure.
This is two a hyphenated name, sort of. Yeah, Gaudier hyphen Brzeska. He died. Wow, 1891 and 15. That's getting 24, 25. That's getting close.
It is.
1891, so 9 years, 1524. Yeah, see, he doesn't make 27, but he's not young.
He could be an honorary member. Close
right.
enough.
He started it. Now, what was
he
the,
started
now we
it.
Go to, yeah, now we go to YouTube, and let's just see if they've got Savage Messiah available.
Film.
Yeah, I'm looking at it. Savage Messiah is a band.
You can buy it on YouTube for $2.99. You can rent it.
Oh, okay. So there's a clip. Often, though, someone will stick it up. Doesn't seem to be available for free.
No, that's what I said. For $2.99, you can rent it.
So that's good?
Yeah, $2.99, that's less than a cup of coffee.
Okay. So we'll get a review of that from you.
Yeah, I would love to do that. Yeah.
Yep.
Absolutely.
So it's just before World War I is the timing of the movie. That's when
okay.
the board is service, 1914. Now, we're going to be talking about Lewis later in this essay. It ends with Lewis for a very important point. So... anyways, I think Brzezinski, the modernists, which the vortices were sort of part of, they're looking at the arts. In many ways, the arts are obsolete, so they're trying to figure out what use of it is. So they're really questioning the form and be experimental with the form. They're not trying to make something look really good, replica of David or something. They're not into the content. So that's I'm saying it because when McCoon says formal, it doesn't mean being, proper.
Yeah.
It's a formal dance, You wear formal clothes. It means studying the language of forms.
Like literally formal.
Yeah, formal.
Formal, yeah. Then he makes a comment about Gerald Manley Hopkins, who is a priest. So
yeah, Gerard, not Gerald, Gerard.
I'm sorry, you're right, there's no L. Gerard Manley Hopkins. It says, Father Hopkins was trying desperately to say this, but all he succeeded in doing was inventing a couple of very quaint terms like in-stress and inscape and sprung rhythm. All these terms mean the same thing. They mean that the thingness of things must come through them, and you must not be reported and must not be reported or described. And that kind of reminds me of a lot of the way that you interpret stuff, because you're always saying, I don't have a point of view, I'll take on a mood if you want, but I'm just describing it.
Yeah, I'm looking at the thingness of you, the thingness of things. And that's the thingness is the object is starting to stand out as a figure because you've moved into electronic flow or invisibility or non-visual space. The object becomes intrusive. It's not the ground. The ground is this invisible electronic flow or tactility that's come in with the telegraph, telephone, movies, and the car.
Is that similar to the way a picture would appear on a screen? Like this, I'm thinking about static on a television screen, and then all of a sudden it comes into focus and an object's there.
Yeah, that's the content of the screen, and it's an image. It's not even the object. It's an image of the object.
Mm-hmm.
So objectness, now other movements in art at the time was the Russian constructivists, Leger and the guys who took machine steel materials and made art out of that. That was a new subject for painting, was the what later Siegfried Gideon, James Joyce's buddy, said, mechanization takes command. So the art of machines starts to rise as a figure as people move into the software world of the teens and 20s, which is radio, phonographs, telephones, telegraph, whatever other stuff. A lot of the TELE media, telegraph, telephone. So, and that's why Joyce, you know, he makes Ulysses, and they think it's stream of consciousness writing. But it's actually the flow of a movie, of a film screen, the flow of images.
Mm-hmm.
People didn't recognize the movie environment. It wasn't that obvious to them. They were inside the content of it. And so they thought that Joyce was doing something with the voice, stream of consciousness. They didn't know he was just taking the movie form and matching it with the newspaper form. So you'll see McLuhan talk about this in different places. He's not talking about it here. He's talking about it differently. And he's talking to a bunch of priests at St. Michael's College in University of Toronto. So he's going to have, he has a certain thing he's saying to these, he has a purpose for these priests.
So what's his purpose?
He has an effect he wants to create. Well, we're gonna see that later.
Okay.
Said yet.
Because this is different than when he's talking to individual priests in his letters. Like this address isn't a conversation.
Yeah.
It's an address, so it's different.
That's right. Yeah.
So then he makes another point about artists. My point is that artists with the Romantics in a most earnest manner took up the cause of formal causality. Only they talked about formal causality as if it were art in which the forms of things began to be insisted upon as having something to say to man, and above all, that they had the power to train human sensibility. Not the power to impose systems of thought, but to train human sensibility. All the Romantics in all fields have been harping, and harping is a good word, on that theme, that art has the power to train human sensibility, to give you eyes, to give you ears. Then he starts to talk about Alexander Pope and the Dunciad. But I wonder if you have anything more to say about, I mean, is he just trying to introduce how we are massaged by media?
No, what's important is the word formal causality there.
Okay.
He's going to talk about that more and more through the years later. That's an interesting early use of it. He's saying that the arts were looking at the form of things, and that's formal causality. Well, actually, he later says formal causality is one of the four Aristotelian causes where they are, you're looking at the audience, the object is for. You study the audience. Advertising takes over in the 20th century, so the art of formal causality resumes its prominence, whereas for 300 or 400 years, formal causality was forgotten about. As you moved into the printing press and then the development of industrial hardware technologies, nobody was caring about what were the effects of these hardware machines. They just wanted them under the rubric or goal of progress, right?
Right.
Food, agricultural, basic survival, stuff that hardware deals with, that they said, let that go forward and we'll have abundance. So progress, progress, progress. But then they ran into the electric age in World War I, and that moved reality into another level, which sort of put the kibosh on hardware. So hardware became either considered to be polluting or a nuisance, or they became fanatics about it. And so the Nazis and the fascists said, no, we're going back to hardware with our particular tribal stamp put on it, and the heck with this software effect. So the especially World War II, as McLuhan said, is the establishment using the new media to do the work of yesterday. Using new media to do the work of yesterday, which would be the industrial hardware thing. So the arts are in the middle of these debates. And they're first to point out formal causality, but it'll soon be superseded by advertising as the 20th century art form.
Mm-hmm.
As McLuhan says, the greatest art form of the 20th century is advertising.
So and that's when he wrote Mechanical Bride.
Right. and in the late 40s. So he would say, now, whether the advertising creator, executive has a benign motive or not is another matter, but they are studying the effects of things, like art always did, or at least art in the 19th century and the 18th century. So looking at the effects of things became the anchor point of the economy, advertising. Advertising was seen as a useful instruction to people on what to consume and how to consume it and what's the meaning of it.
Mm-hmm.
So it was the 1984 brainwashing that everybody worried about was happening politically with 1984, the novel, talking about 1934, but it was already happening in the advertising world. But nobody
recognized that. So it was happening in consumer economy.
Yeah, and people thought that was good. You know, they thought they would keep buying stuff. And they are, in the first half of the 20th century, buying hardware stuff, just getting cars and whatever other
washing
hardware
machines
stuff.
Washing machines, TV.
What'd you say? That's the second half of the 20th century.
Oh.
Washing machines, TVs, that's the second half. That's when software really takes over. But in the first half of the 20th century, it's the software dreams. You know, like the New York World's Fair, I think in 1939, they'll show you know, futurist societies with all this hardware abundance. Everybody's got an airplane. No, they got a car and an airplane in their backyard. And I don't know, they maybe have some rails, public rail systems. But that didn't really come in because, in a strong way, because Americans went out to be alone. Nobody knew about that. So they couldn't leave their cars. They liked traffic jams so they could think about their day. They'd have the privacy of it. But anyways, back to this point, he's keeping it simple in the 50s there. So he's saying artists are into formal causality.
Right. And then he mentions Alexander Pope, and that was back in the 1720s when he published the Dunciad. So Pope saw back in the 1720s that there would be swarms of books settling upon the human spirit, causing disaster.
Well, okay, read the sentence clearly.
What Alexander Pope in the 1720s published the first drafts of the Dunciad. That amazing work is an epic song announcing universal disaster to the world. She comes, the sable throne behold, of night primeval and chaos old. The darkness he saw settling over the earth in the European spirit was the darkness of books. The first line of the original poem are, books and the man I sing, the first who brings the Smithfield muses to the ears of kings. Kings who substitute the bestseller for taught oral counsel in the ears of monarchy. The Dunciad is an epic to the disaster of books, mass-produced swarms of books, settling upon the human spirit. Then he says, I'm not saying that Pope was right, I'm simply saying that he offered this testimony in 1720.
Yes, the it's like the first mediaecology intuition. The selling of books, been going on for a couple hundred years, has now created a bestseller kind of situation where hundreds of authors are trying to get their books sold and are putting junk out from the aesthete and intellectual aristocrat Alexander Pope's point of view. And he complains about the dullness, D-U-L-N-E-S-S, that's happening in the population from reading too many books. So this is a very avant-garde perception because people still want books. You know, 150 years ago, they're just starting to get education for the poor people, you know, public education. But he's talking about the effects 150 years before as this is not good.
Right.
And so McLuhan says, Pope began with the Dunciad, and 200 years later, 1920s, James Joyce wrapped it up and concluded, sort of completed the vision of Pope with Finnegan's Wake. So it goes from Dunciad to Finnegan's Wake is the prophetic series artist of the Gutenberg Galaxy. Neat thing to know about. And, you know, Belinda the Hen a major character in Finnegan's Wake is a character in The Rape of the Lock. I think the courtesan is named Belinda.
I don't know.
Yeah, this is... I can.
But I believe you, for sure.
Yeah, The Rape of the Lock, famous Alexander Pope poem.
Okay.
Let's see.
So, then he goes, he's talking more about artisans saying that if society is to be saved, even in an elementary way, it would only be by putting artists in charge. And then
yeah.
I made a note, so the entertainment industry is in charge. Is that art now?
No.
Move.
No.
No.
No. See, there's where... You have to know what McLuhan means by art. He's not talking about the galleries. He's saying a serious artist is someone who questions the deepest assumptions of the culture. So someone like Wyndham Lewis is doing that. McLuhan says he's a giant, and he's going to end with talking about Lewis in this talk. He's a giant in 1914, 1920, but he's considered an enemy because he's not going along with the Bloomsbury art as commerce game.
Mm-hmm.
He objects to Picasso and Cubism in 1919, by saying these artists are wasting their talents by working in studios. They should be helping the city program whole urban environments, designing environments. So he was starting to see the artistic talent, the really good genius artists, should not be making little paintings for aristocrats or a consuming middle class. They should be helping design and program the environment. So you're going to see McLuhan go towards that idea in this talk. So he starts off saying the artists are important, but then he's going to say a particular kind of artist. All right? So.
Okay.
This is the drama to follow in his lecture.
So do we have any artists like that today? Who would be an artist like that today?
Me.
Okay.
With Ion. Me and Carolyn with Ion. We are the greatest artists alive today. We're programming environments with our products. And we'll be bringing in the Coldplay. And we're huge in that tradition of art. But we're not going to limit ourselves to being an artist. We are uncategorizable. But you bring up any artist today, they're puny compared to what we're doing.
Sure.
They serve their function in a local ecology, a local business culture. Yes, you know, who would be someone today, right today? Snoopy. Oh, what's his name? Snoop Dogg. I saw him in some press conference. He's announced something. He's some kind of investor or something. You know, Snoop Dogg?
Of course.
Yeah, he's a local artist working with Silicon Valley.
Okay.
That's content stuff. And real art is always not recognized, generally not liked. It's too upsetting. But here's this great, you know, the epitome of art triumph in the modernist age of Cubism. And Picasso is going to go on to become considered pretty well the greatest artist of the 20th century. And Lewis in 1919 say, Pablo, you're doing it wrong. Get the heck out of your studio. Get down to City Hall and let's go in there as a team and program this situation. Else we're going to have a lot of somnambulists that'll lead to a war. Okay, so that's the,
okay.
He was saying that, and nobody was paying attention to him, but he was writing it. Okay, back to what you were saying.
So then he talks about formal cause again, to return to art and formal causality for the moment. A formal cause exerts its pressure non-verbally and non-conservatively. Any substantial form impresses itself upon you without benefit of awareness or conscious attention on your part. You can be conscious about it if I think I might have missed a word because I copied this. If it impresses us steadily and constantly without intermission, without benefit of words or thoughts, they are total in their action upon us. It doesn't matter what theory we may have about them. Their effect upon us is quite independent of any thought we have about them. It is the same with a work of art. The meaning of a work of art, as the artist of past centuries can tell us, has nothing to do with what you think about it. It has to do with its action upon you. It is a form. It acts upon you. It invades your senses. It restructures your outlook. It completely changes your attitudes, your wavelengths. So our attitudes, our sensibilities are completely altered by new forms, regardless of what we think about them. This is not an irrational statement or a philosophical notion. It is a simple fact of experience.
Right, so you started off at the beginning of what you read talking about media environments shape us, and then he says that's the role of art, traditionally. He's later going to say media environments are the new art. So he's talking about how art affects people, but that's 1700s, 1800s, with novels and paintings and Beethoven, these guys. You know, it's a smaller media world, so the arts shape people. But by the time you get to World War One, the dadaists, the vortices, a lot of artists are starting to question that role, that Gutenbergian role of art, and they want to become influential on another level. So they start looking at machine culture as something they want to engage in. So they make their paintings emphasize the mechanical aspects as if it's beautiful or sublime. But Lewis says, well, I'm not even going to bother making a painting. I'm going to take over the society. That's why he was always fascinated with the Nazis and the new emperors coming on the scene. He was sort of watching them, willing to be an advisor to them, because he saw these environments were bigger than the old aims of art. So McLuhan's mixing up several things here. He's looking at a 100-year span and sort of not giving the stages of his generalizations. He's saying art does this and that, but actually art was not doing that by World War One. The media were becoming, the electronic environments were becoming the new shapers of people. But he may say that later, but...
Well, he does say... Go ahead.
No, that's it. Go ahead.
Okay, so he makes a little... I'm not going to read the whole quote, but he makes another little statement about... don't look at the content of a work of art because it's just a sugar coating to slip past your conscious awareness to let the real work of art do its work upon you unimpeded. And then he wraps up this paragraph with the statement, everything happens at once. What we must have, therefore, is a means of coping with an all-at-once world. The artist and philosopher can perhaps help us here. So he's...
Right.
He set this...
That's an interesting point. He's talking about history of art as people understood it, and all of a sudden he's jumping to the present and saying, you know, we've got this simultaneous global theater going on. The arts can help us, but he doesn't mean the regular arts. He puts out a book in 1970 called Culture is Our Business, and he says that the arts and even science do not serve as anti-environments anymore. They're too puny. What you need is someone who's modulating the global environments with a computer, saying, you know, a little more radio in Venezuela to counter the hot effect of newspapers. Maybe bring some TV into France to cool down that culture. He's modulating globally, like an antichrist, the whole world. That's what the artist should be. He's the only guy saying it. He's the only artist on the planet at that time.
Uh-huh.
He doesn't say this blatantly, but you'll find out later, understanding his other meetings, this is what he's getting at. But he's talking to a bunch of priests in a little Catholic college, with these huge ideas that are, you know, people can't even get a handle on what he's really saying. So the arts become the content of imperialism, if you want to get into capitalism. Capitalism moves to software. So culture, all levels of it, become business. And so you have all the big corporations being seen funding the Olympics or funding orchestras, city orchestras, all the traditional arts had big corporate sponsors, you know, by 1970. You know what I mean? Did you guys see that?
Yeah.
So the corporations aren't asking for people to give us perception. They're not asking the artist to be what the real artist should be. those guys are ignored. When you read the biography of Wyndham Lewis, man, that guy got nailed every day by the corporate cultural zombies of his time in London. So McLuhan got nailed. You know, when you're a real artist on the way McLuhan's talking about it, you don't take over and make your paintings or music mandatory to be heard. He's talking about modulating what's shaping people. He defines art as a teaching machine. The traditional arts, the Gutenberg arts, were teaching machines, but they're not teaching machines in the 20th century. The electric, radio, TV, movie, computers are the teaching machines.
Right.
So what he's talking about there as art, you're going to project back paintings and music and traditional arts, what I call Gutenbergian arts, and think he's defining that and probably say, yeah, maybe they are training our perception. Yeah, maybe some of the better arts, like Cubism, trains people. Everybody thought it was nuts at first, but they were altered by it because it resonated with the present. So he's helping you look at the history of art, but he's actually talking about the present and what to do about it as a new kind of artist, a new kind of artist and scientist. Okay? So So watch that as you read what he's saying.
Okay. I wanted to talk about... Oh, keep reading? Okay, that's fine. I wanted to talk more about Lewis.
Did you write
what
this out? Did you say you wrote this out?
No, I copied it. When I copied the pages for Kate, I just wrote on those pages instead of writing my book.
Oh, okay.
Because that
keeps
my book
fresh. Yeah, so
you're
reading what the book says.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right.
No, I didn't write this all out. Let's see. Then he
What's
talks
the next
about...
Sense? He's
okay.
Laying out an argument there. What you read, just continue.
Oh, I was going to read what I highlighted, that I had moved to that.
No, go to what you read and read the next couple lines.
Okay.
He says simultaneity, or everything's all at once. Was this
everything's all at once. I'm sorry, I was flipping ahead because I wanted to look at some Lewis stuff. To return to art and formal causality for a moment, a formal cause exerts pressure on the... Okay, we read that. It's the same with a work of art. The meaning of a work of art, as the artists of past centuries can tell us, has nothing to do with what you... Okay, we read that. I'm prepared to say that the new media of communication are forms, not simple ones, but complex forms. But they are forms, and that their effect upon us is that of forms, not of ideas or concepts. The editorials of a newspaper have nothing to do with the effect of the newspaper on you. Whether it's Pravda, the New York Times, or the Toronto Daily Star, makes no difference as far as the formal causal pressure of that newspaper on those concerned. Just why people should be so obsessed by what they suppose to be the content of these forms, and so completely unaware of the formal structure and the formal causes of such forms, I do not understand. The artists have been telling us this in their own way for a long time. Don't be taken in by the so-called content of a work of art, because it is just a sugar coating to slip past your conscious awareness to let the real work of art do its work upon you unimpeded. Artists have been telling us this for centuries. Hopkins said it, and everyone since Hopkins. The so-called meaning is a way of lowering your guard so the form can work upon you. And the artist who sharpens his work to a high and good moral purpose gets past the guard of a good many people with the form. He even gets past his own guard. He is often the victim of his own strategies. So why is it impossible to take one thing at a time in the world that we live in? The global village is not a place where one thing happens at a time. Everything happens at once. What we must have, therefore, is a means of coping with the all-at-once world. The artist and philosopher can perhaps help us here. A formal cause, let me just anticipate a little, we can go into more depth later, as it exists in an actual technical situation, has a pro-form of technology which is not proportional to the senses, whether it is a telephone or radio or print or any other language. Or put it this way, they say that it's impossible that there could ever be a scientific concept that is not embedded in the vernacular tongue of the scientist, and that has not been embedded there for many centuries. You cannot conceive of a form of scientific hypothesis which is not part of your own language, implicit in that language. All the mathematics in the world are externalizations of a certain linguistic pattern. What the poets were saying, now more widely...
What he's saying is that every language evokes the science of that culture. The concepts, the theories that a culture comes up with in science are a product of the formal dynamics of the language of the culture. So that's a pretty controversial statement. Mm-hmm. Einstein's E equals MC squared was a product of the media mix of his day.
Okay.
All right, that's what he's saying there. Yeah, carry on. This is good.
Okay. The proportionalities in things and between things and our senses and so embodied in language itself are inexhaustible. The particular technology of a time releases some of that inexhaustible store of analogical intuition and experience, which is language. So television releases within language a whole body of resources which has been bound up there for centuries. But this does not depend upon concepts. It has to do with sensibility and observation, analogical perception, right in the structure of language itself. Let me mention another basic matter in this connection. In an all-at-once order, the electronic type, where information moves instantly and in mass, the only possible form of intelligible order is auditory. Harmony can be made of a great mass of seemingly disconnected fragments, but it is impossible to have a visual order of a vast, unassorted mass of data, as is typical of every moment of experience in the electronic age. You cannot fill it in. Look at what happens to the newspaper page under the impact of the telegraph. When the telegraph began to exert direct pressure upon the structure of news from about 1850 and certainly thereafter, the news began to flow in so fast that it was impossible to give it visual order or any kind of perspective or point of view. If you're going to receive reports from news services around the entire globe, you cannot ask or expect your reporters around the globe to have a single consistent point of view. At the same time, what they did send in is quite useless because it cannot be ordered into a single day's news unless it does have a single point of view. You as an editor cannot assemble it under a single dateline at high speeds unless it has some form of consistency. So they hit upon what is known as objective reporting, which has nothing to do with objectivity. It means get rid of all feelings, all attitudes, all blocks to a mosaic. But you cannot have your daily mosaic if authors have private points of view.
Isn't that pretty awesome? He's saying that.
It's really awesome. Pretty awesome.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
It's pretty amazing.
You see, like, he's way above everybody, or he's looking at it so different. So he stands out. He's the artist of his day. And he's also invading science there. He's eventually going to do a book on the laws of media, the new science. And regular scientists, they think this is nonsense. But where they've gotten, science is really bogged down with crap now. And they don't even look respectable. We get real good examples of that in medicine with the pharmaceutical scientists, what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a garbage profession now, obsolete. Art itself is obsolete. So where are we at? So you can apply what McLuhan's saying here and then put ION in there. Every statement there works as a good definition of what ION's doing. You can't work with concepts. Even percepts with ION, ION's communicating on another level and affecting you besides the products that ION makes. So this is what's interesting about McLuhan for me, is that his language is prophetic and can be used, applied to IONdom. It's like you could reread what you just read and put the word ION in instead of artist. Where is he going next? Let's see if we can do that. Does he keep talking about art? Or media environments, even media environments put an ION in.
Yeah, now he's starting to talk about how when you've got this auditory order and visual order, it causes a frightful conflict for kids in the classroom.
Yeah.
So you want me to read some of that, or do you want to, what do you want
to do? No, that's good. I was just thinking that when he says it can't be visualized, what's going on, that means math doesn't apply. And then you get all these revolutions in math. In the 20th century, they try to visualize what can't be visualized. just one example, one visual art or science of math, McLuhan says, can't be done. But there's a lot of people going to college, studying math, getting degrees, and maybe getting jobs with it or teaching it, carries on as a meme, as a powerful after image. So you got a lot of after images happening lately, after images of these environments. But yeah, let's see if we can apply Ion to the next part in education.
Okay, the ordinary kid in the classroom today has this enormous built-in bias. The world he lives in, auditory order, in the world he lives in, auditory order is the only kind he's ever experienced, whether from a newspaper, television, movie, or top 60, or anything else.
Okay, what you put in there, the world he lives in, the ion order, okay?
Mm-hmm.
The ion, just substitute for media environments, the ion.
In the world order he lives in, ion order is the only kind he has ever experienced. Whether from a newspaper, television, movie, or top 60 or anything else, ion order is an all-at-once sort of being with it, harmonizing equilibrium and so on, he understands. But when he is presented with, now this is visual order, but when he is presented, so would I say ion order again? No?
No, no.
So what he's saying is he lives in an auditory...
The Abrahams or Edgar Cayce or the Marion
okay,
Williams...
Okay, but when he's presented with the law of attraction, in which a subject is given to him in visual terms, one thing following another, he finds it absolutely meaningless. And teachers don't seem to understand why children should feel this frightful conflict between these two kinds of order.
Right. Between ion that they hear their parents listening to on the radio and what their teacher is saying in school. Big conflict for the kid who happens to be frequenting ion them households.
Yep.
Now what the kid doesn't know is that ion is also keeping the economy going with the $700 billion bailouts, right? So the kid can still go to school.
And have this frightful conflict.
Yes. The kids know something's wrong.
Yep.
Nobody's telling what's really happening.
Yep.
Okay, so
I don't think this matter is limited to children, although it has become pathological by the 15th-year level. After all, television is 10 years old. This is 1959. So an average 15-year...
Okay, he's saying Iondom is 10 years old.
Iondom is 10 years old. This is 2018. So an average 15-year-old has grown up entirely on ion.
Yes.
There should be quite a difference between the mentalities of a 15- and 20-year-old. There should be quite a cultural gap in those people.
Yep.
Let us look at this matter of ion order and Church of Oprah order. The Middle Ages were not visual. They were... oral and
the George Bush administration, before Ion showed up in 2009, which is during Obama. So the George Bush administration, what's he say about them?
He's saying we're not visual, so he would say was not ionized.
Right.
Right. They were oral in their ideas of things. There was no perspective, no point of view. It was an all-at-once mosaic. Their concept of order...
That was the retrieved orality of the TV global theater phase. And George Bush Jr. was the epitome of that. Remember, he didn't process information. He just shrugged and
smiled and grinned.
Purposeful. And, yeah, tried to be purposeful and say the right words.
Yep.
Yeah. He was medieval.
Oh.
Neo-medieval. Running the global serfdom. A thing that all the kids started yelling at the end of his administration with Occupy Wall Street.
Well, thank God we invented the stirrup then, huh?
Yep.
So he could get up on the horse.
Well, the president is there to stir up the population.
Ah! Okay. Yeah, good one.
The new kind of stirrup.
Very quick. Very quick. In your orality.
That's right, very, very fast.
Very fast.
Okay, so it just so read the next part.
Okay, so there was no perspective, no point of view. It was an all-at-once mosaic. Their concept of order and their concept of learning was oral. Everything happened at once. You gradually penetrated a field deeper and deeper, but if you look at the whole field simultaneously, but you took in the whole field simultaneously.
Yeah,
like
now that's the description of the White House. The human scale, oral White House, the word makes the market, is pre-ION. And that's the George Bush. He was the final zombie of it.
Mm.
And then they put in the perfect president, Obama, and he didn't do too well either.
Right.
Because it's all a neo-retrieval, avoiding the present, which is Iondom.
In the Chimpocalypse.
Yeah. The Chick-apocalypse?
No, the Trumpocalypse.
That's later. That's a later situation.
Oh. Okay. The idea of taking one thing at a time and of there being natural sequence in which to present order was inconceivable, is inconceivable. He's saying was, but it still is.
And Reagan,
it's even worse.
One thing at a time, presidents.
Mm.
And they were disasters. Because you can't do that one thing at a time, sequential thinking, in the White House. Because all around you is the all-at-once world.
So then he gives this analogy of what it's like, and he says it would be like trying to present to a primitive African a page of print and explaining to him that all those marks were words that he spoke every day, and that the same African, in that same African, a picture or snapshot of himself, it would take quite a while to explain the relation between him and those strange shapes on the card. Without training, he can't see a picture or adopt a point of view. Whether you hold it upside down or sideways makes no difference to him at all.
Right. So to the average American or world citizen harassed with their four bodies, ION doesn't make any sense at all unless there's some training happening. Or take the product.
Uh-huh.
That's how I'd update that.
Okay.
But go back to what McLuhan's saying.
So so McLuhan said that the African would not... I read that, so you're getting that he would not understand. But what he says is, there's no upside down until you learn to read and write. Psychologists have at least shown this. Until you learn to read and write and notice letters on a line right side up, there is no horizontal or vertical axis in the visible world. Cave painters used no horizontal or visual axis. They painted. They would just be happy painting on this, just as happy painting on this microphone head as anywhere else, such as back here or under here, and they painted one picture on top of another and all around. What's making you laugh?
Just all of it? And painting comes up and starts painting on McLuhan's jacket while he's talking. They paint anywhere. There's no container to paint inside of. It's not going to a gallery.
Right.
They'll paint anywhere.
Right.
And that's like ION will show up anywhere.
Yep. Could show up right now.
Yeah.
Yep. Probably not, though. There was no question that one meeting should follow another. They were all together, all over the place, all through each other.
Now, he's describing Finnegan's Wake. He's not saying it, but that's the way Finnegan's Wake looks when you start to learn how to read it.
Yep.
So, again, he's a subliminal project is translating Finnegan's Wake, which anticipates ION, completes the Bible, and anticipates ION on perceptual fronts. And that's what McLuhan's secretly doing there.
Yep.
One step removed from ION. He's describing Finnegan's Wake in the world.
Okay, so, you know, he does make one, there's like five more pages in this talk, but looking ahead, he only mentions Lewis at the end.
Yes. We're going to get to that. It's a real important point.
Well, I mean, I want to know what Lewis was doing through all this.
Oh, he was painting and writing. This is 1914 to 19. Lewis dies in 1957. Joyce dies in 1941. So on the modernist artists that McLuhan is referring to, they're all 50 years before, because the media started to take over after World War II, even before World War II, if you consider the effects of radio in the 30s. So McLuhan is spanning a 150-year span, jumping from one aspect to another, because where does he begin? Since nobody knows what he's talking about or even believes it, he's got a major task of explaining his point. And so he's actually describing how he's like Finney's Wake. He swarms over a topic or a theme from all points of view. That's what he's doing here. He's trying to wake up these priests and whoever else is there in Toronto listening. And he's miming what has to be done by showing how previous artists did that, a serious artist.
Is he thinking that he can, like, incite the priests to do the? I mean, because he's not mentioning the church at all in this.
No, well, we're going to get to that later.
Okay, all right.
Let me just see, is that you, Kate? There's a new...
Yeah, that's me.
Hi, Kate.
Right, so you're here.
Hi.
Yay. Good morning.
I've been listening, Bob.
Okay, is there anything you want to say at this point?
Yeah, I thought it was cool about learning about the All at Once. And I feel like I've had a few Eureka moments during this part. Hearing Katie read it back with you putting Ion in makes sense.
Yeah.
You're putting Ion in wherever she would say visual.
No. Ion goes for any reference to new media environments, the electric age, the all-at-once world. All the electric characteristics are substituted by Ion. Visual space would be the pre-Ion world. Because he's saying visual order doesn't work anymore. He's educating the priests that their visual bias is really making them incompetent. And he's explained to them why the new environment makes their visual bias obsolete, irrelevant. Well, that's what Ion tells you. Ion tells you that most of your thoughts and perceptions are rather out of sync with what's actually happening around you.
Okay.
But that's what I was doing, Kate. If you were following along, there weren't very many places in the part that I was reading that were, as Bob just described, the all-at-once-ness. So I was sticking it in. The conversation was visual and auditory, so we were just using it for visual. So you're both right. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Well, if you're going to get to the oral, the oral, he says, is an oral world, the electric world, and he means the oral content. The visual content isn't as strong anymore. The oral is. Then Ion presents itself as an oral phenomenon. We started off in 2009 writing books, but we ditched that pretty quickly because I realized Ion is more of an oral phenomenon. We got to get on the radio. So we had to update how Ion was presented. So we went oral, right? And then we found out that Ion was communicating in many other domains rather than just the oral.
Yeah.
So the basic point here that... Katie's reading about how the oral world has been retrieved from before the print world. The medieval orality, the tribal orality, has come back to dominate the late 50s. And visually biased people are anemic, weak. That's one of the levels he's commenting on here. But he's trying to explain the causes. He's not for the oral world. He says this oral world is so prominent because you can't stop it when you don't understand how media environments favor the orality over the visual.
Mm-hmm.
Like he's telling the symphony orchestras in Toronto, you got this great classical heritage, but why is nobody coming to your concerts? Why are they going to the clubs and doing the twist, 59, 60, 61? Why are they into Elvis? Why is all this new stuff happening? And it's not because of the content. It's not that Elvis is better than the symphony orchestra. It's the rhythms of Elvis meet the rhythms of the global theater. When you have an environment of TV, computers, and satellites impinging on the whole world, that's a rocking world. The proprioceptor world. So you need a different kind of music to match where people are living. So if you industrial symphony orchestras want to keep going and mean something, you're going to have to lobby to turn off the TV environment. the only way. You're going to have to lobby to turn off the new music, which is tactile electricity, rather than your old visually organized music. And nobody could do anything about it, and so the symphonies all died or got funded by corporations or losing proposition overall. I remember when we lived in Halifax, the Halifax Symphony Orchestra was always begging for money. He couldn't get anybody to come to the concerts to be economically viable. That's because Zappa was afoot. Zappa was taking everything away from those people. The Zappa age, which was the, you know, the rock age. And then became the disco age, and the punk age, then techno wave, then hip-hop, rap, and now Dobstown. All right, thank you. The greatest music alive today. Here's Bob's latest production, his latest hit. Here it is, and you listen for an hour and a half, 90 minutes. Oh, man, at the end of 90 minutes, the DJ says, oh, that was a long song. That's longer than Dylan.